Welcome to Module 5 of the Bridge Qualitative Research Microcourse. This module will discuss how we report qualitative research findings. I'm Brenna Bray. I'm your instructor for the course. I have a PhD in biomedical science and neuroscience and postdoctorate training in complementary and integrative health that really centered on qualitative research use. I received my postdoc training as part of the Bridge R90 T90 Fellowship Postdoctoral Training Program, for which this course is designed. And development of this course was supported by an NCCIH grant, AT008924. So, in this module, we're going to talk about how we report qualitative research findings. We're going to talk about reporting priorities, reporting tips, reporting components, and then we'll get into a little bit of an application. Again, there will be a quiz at the end of this module. That quiz is going to be worth just 6 questions, so 12 points. It'll be worth 12% of our course grade. We'll be pulling primarily from section 5 of the Barium and Lenz 2019 textbook that addresses reporting findings. We'll reference also some reporting guidelines that we'll come back to and really touch on in Module 6. And by the end of this module, you should be able to develop research questions that are consistent with the use of qualitative methodology and be able to communicate findings from qualitative analyses. So let's get started. The impact of our work after we've done this qualitative research, we've gone through this whole process of identifying our key sources. Like we've identified a really important research question, we've identified our key sources, we've thought through how we want to collect our data, we've done that, we've collected our data, we've analyzed our data, we've coded it, we've identified codes, categories, and themes, and now we're ready to present our data. The impact of our work is really closely tied to how well we report our findings. So this piece is really crucial, and here are some key considerations. We want to make sure that we're really transparent in reporting our methodology. We're really transparent in reporting what we did, and that really can help reinforce the validity of our methods. We want to be very clear in our themes and categories. And we want to show the data that's used to support our assertions or our themes or our conclusions. So we want to be sure that we provide clear descriptions of a few key components. First, we want to provide clear descriptions of our research purpose and the focus of our inquiry. We want to address data collection and analysis methodology very clearly. And this would include recruitment or selection processes, participant roles and demographic characteristics, individuals involved in the process, data collection and analysis methods, safeguards to ensure trustworthiness and ethics. And I think that's it. Then we also want to clearly describe the themes and categories that we derive from the data. Generally, it's suggested to use tables to name and describe themes and categories, especially when you might have tighter word counts or word allotments in manuscripts. It's suggested to use about 2 to 3 quotes or statements to support and lift each theme. Now, as a qualitative researcher, I find it really hard sometimes to pick out just 2 or 3 statements, but I do find that if you have more than that, the reader will kind of glaze over them. So really, just 2 to 3 quotes or statements to support or lift each theme. And if you want, you can include a couple of extra quotes in the table. And then you want to consider also maybe using figures to show thematic relationships. And I'm going to give you an example of my own research and some kind of fun things that we're doing with our research at NOURISHED, the Nourished Research Foundation. So, in my 2022 publication that identified environmental factors that experts associate with eating disorders, we identified 12 key environmental factors that experts most strongly, most commonly, most frequently, and most prevalently associate with binge eating disorder. Now, when we actually published this data, we had only identified 11 of them. I've since gone back and added the first theme as I've recognized it. So these themes are invalidating environments and experiences, systematic issues, marginalized populations or marginalization, economic precarity, stigmatization and discrimination, trauma and adversity, food insecurity, interpersonal factors, social messaging and social media, nutrition scarcity, predatory food industry practices and environments, and research gaps and future directions. And the parentheses here shows the percent of experts who were interviewed in my 2022 study who endorsed, spontaneously endorsed these themes, meaning they said something that was coded as a code within this theme, without prompting, generally. And so, in this publication that I'm showing here that we're getting ready to submit this month, actually, one of my research assistants at the Nourished Research Foundation, Rishi Lamashane, is very interested in, kind of statistics, higher level statistics, and biostatistics. And so, when I shared this data with Rishi, Rishi said, what if we were to kind of develop a network map for this data? So Rishi developed a protocol that he could use to identify a network map to kind of show how all of these different environmental factors are related. And this is a draft copy. We're not quite done with this yet, but what you can see, if binge eating disorder is the center, you can see we have certain themes that are most strongly associated with binge eating disorder. So systematic issues and systems of oppression, invalidating environments, and marginalized and underrepresented populations. And then you can see a lot of the sub-themes that overlap. So, for example, justice systems and police harassment was identified as an invalidating environment and a systemic issue. Here we've got significantly relevant to binge eating disorder pathology, insurance and healthcare systems, which is identified as a systematic issue. Let me see if I can find, here we go. So, legal systems, social systems, geographic systems, relationships described as exclusively positive. So these are all systemic issues. And then some of these also relate to social messaging and social media. Some of them relate to interpersonal factors and trauma and adversity. So we can just start to kind of see how these all map. Now, again, this map that I'm showing here is in a very early draft form still. But it's just one way that we can represent our data visually that can be kind of helpful for qualitative research processes. So I think we kind of went over this already. So we want to, when we're reporting our findings, we want to provide clear descriptions of our inquiry purpose and focus, our data collection and analysis methods, our themes and categories derived from the data, and we want to note the frequency, the prevalence, and the weight intensity. And you'll recall in module, I think it was 3, I shared some of my own research where we went through this, and I'll have that presentation linked to this module as well. So when we're noting the frequency, prevalence, and weight intensity, frequency, we're just going to note the number of mentions for a specific code. And we might say, the number of participants who mentioned this, or the number of times that it was mentioned, or the number of documents that it was mentioned, but really just anything having to do with the frequency. Prevalence, we're going to talk about the number of participant endorsements. So that would really be the number of participants who endorsed a theme. And then the weight or intensity kind of communicates the energy around an idea. Were participants in agreement with this? Were they against this? Were they confused about this? Did they recognize this as an area of contention in the field? What was the kind of intensity around it like? There's additional tips in the Baryo-Mittenden Lens textbook provided in Chapter 17, Reporting to Stakeholders. We're not going to go through all those here, but I just want to point out that there are some great resources for that. We'll also get into some more resources on reporting in Module 6. So now we're going to move on and we're going to talk about some tips for high quality reporting. And these are provided in Chapter 17 of the Baryo-Mittenden Lens textbook. So one, you want to report in an accurate, even-handed manner, right? We want to be very objective in our reporting. We want to try to remove subjectivity and biases unless we're explicitly identifying those in the discussion section. You want to account for your audience. Be aware of who's going to read this. What is their reading level? What are they familiar with? What are they not familiar with? And a lot of these things we want to really address and think about when we're crafting our introduction and our background section of our manuscript, right? Are there any terms that we're using that our readers might not be familiar with? Are our readers going to be familiar with qualitative analysis? Maybe we want to even include a little chapter on qualitative analysis in our introduction and background section to kind of help validate its methodology. Is there any information that the readers are going to need to know to be able to interpret and understand our findings? Any of that's going to go in the background and intro section. Use pluralistic communication strategies. So we, you know, for example, we found this, individuals suspect that, et cetera. Time your reports. Timeliness is so important, right? Really be intentional about getting your reports off and thinking about on both sides, is this manuscript ready to be published, right? And then does it need to be, get it out when it needs to be published. Prioritize documents and materials, and you can even consider including raw data so long as it does not identify any of the participants as supplementary material. Emphasize practical effects and social applications, and this is really what we'll do in the discussion section, which we'll get into more in a little bit. So, some fundamental reporting components. One, a cover page, if we're doing a report. Or if we're preparing a manuscript, this would be our title, our front matter, our author affiliation, et cetera. Then we move on in a report and we're going to have our executive summary. In the manuscript, this is going to be our abstract. We usually save this piece for last, and it's going to be just a one paragraph overview of our report. Then we're going to move on and we're going to provide an overview of the program or role of evaluation. In a manuscript, that's going to be our introduction or background section. Then we're going to evaluate our methodology. So it's going to be our method section in a manuscript. Then we're going to report our findings. This would be the result section of a manuscript and their impact. This would generally be the discussion section of the manuscript, unless we're talking about the impact of an intervention as something that we've assessed or measured. And then it might be included in the results. Then we're going to end with our conclusions, what we make of our findings, and recommendations for future actions or future research. And this is going to be broadly our discussion section. And then we're going to have some appendices in a manuscript. This would be our supplemental material, where maybe we'll include our interview script if we conducted semi-structured interviews. Maybe we'll include a page of our data that we've coded as an example of our coding, things like this. So now we're going to just kind of put it all together. So when we're reporting, we also want to think about what was the purpose of a needs. If we're reporting on a needs assessment, let's say, what was the purpose of the needs assessment? We're going to want to relate the questions that guide the evaluation. Then we're going to provide an overview of our data sources and then put the findings into context. So I'm going to pull an application from my own research and talk about binge eating disorder. National quantitative surveys tell us that between 50 to 95% of folks with binge eating disorder lack awareness of their condition. So 50 to 67% of folks with binge eating disorder don't know that they have an eating disorder. 95% never receive a formal diagnosis. 56 to 87% never access standard treatments. 85% lack access to health care altogether. 95% lack representation in research, and about 60% don't respond to conventional treatments. So, together, cumulatively, this data identifies a few big gaps in the field of binge eating disorder. First of all, we have a treatment gap. 60% of folks don't respond to treatment. But bigger than that, we have a diagnostic gap. 95% of folks who have binge eating disorder never receive a formal diagnosis. So, that 30% who respond to treatment, that's of the 5% that get a diagnosis, and the 50 to about 20% or 30% who are able to access treatment, 10% to 5%, sorry. So we've got a few gaps here. And this data, just this quantitative data, can help us identify those gaps, but it doesn't really give us a whole lot of insight into what's going on, right? And so that's where qualitative data might come into play. Now, I mentioned earlier some of my research that looked at environmental factors associated with binge eating disorder. That was earlier in this module. And we touched on food insecurity as being a big environmental factor that, when present, is strongly associated with binge eating disorder. So we have quantitative data that tells us that food insecurity increases risk of binge eating disorder 1.65-fold, or 165%. Being on government assistance increases the risk of binge eating disorder threefold, 300%. And I think that's actually being on government assistance before the age of 18. And again, we need a greater understanding, though. So this quantitative data kind of tells us there's something going on here, but we don't really know what. So that's where we turn to qualitative research to gain a greater understanding of what is the relationship between food insecurity and binge eating disorder, and what is the experience of individuals who have food insecurity and binge eating disorder, as well as what are their needs, right? So we might conduct a needs assessment to understand the experience of individuals who use food pantries and have an eating disorder, or to understand the relationship between food insecurity and binge eating disorder. And then we might utilize these findings to develop programs that can support these individuals' biologic and psychologic needs. So now we've got our purpose. It's pretty clear, right? Our purpose is to better understand the lived experiences and needs of these individuals so that we can better serve them. So then we're going to develop related questions that are going to guide our evaluation. We might be seeking to understand if food pantry users deliberately try to limit the amount of food they eat for any reason, and if so, why? Or if food pantry users are going for 8 hours or more without eating anything, and why? Or if users are trying to exclude any foods from their diet that they like, and why, right? So we just want to understand what is the nature of the disordered eating here. So, overview of data sources. And now I'm going to get into kind of starting to get into a study that has actually been conducted. On IR approval, researchers contacted food pantries to ask if they would allow data collection. And let me just make sure I didn't skip a slide here. I didn't, but I will make the point. This is now we're getting into a study that was actually conducted by Middlemass, and it's Keisha Middlemass. I'm just going to quick pull this up here so you can see. Here's the study: Food Insecurity and Dietary Restraint in a Diverse Urban Population, conducted by Keisha Middlemass, Jessica Cruz, Alexandra Gambosa, Clara Johnson, Brigette Taylor, Francesca Gomez, and Carolyn Becker. And these are all at the Department of Political Science at Howard University, the Department of Political Science at Trinity University. All right. Okay, so we've got that piece. Here we go. So then they went and began to kind of think about their data sources. So on IRB approval, the researchers contacted food pantries to ask if they would allow data collection, if the food pantries would allow data collection. If the agencies agreed, the RAs, the research assistants, met with staff to discuss food distribution patterns and the best recruitment tactics. So they're working with the staff in how to best even design the study. Then, once they got that piece, the RAs made contact with the clients, the users of the food pantry, and they used a recruitment script to recruit food pantry users to participate in their study. Then, once recruited, they used paper surveys to administer informed consent and after informed consent. Oh, excuse me. And then the RAs were available for questions, survey collection, and resources throughout the informed consent process. So, what are their findings? Now, this study was done at two different food pantries in San Antonio, Texas, and they found that 52% of food pantry users reported restricting their food or eating or fasting for more than 8 hours. And this data was collected between 2015 to 2016. They also found that when individuals who reported trying to restrict their food or go more than 8 hours without eating had significant, these behaviors significantly correlated with increased weight or BMI and increased eating disorder pathology. And we can see we've got an R value of 0.25 and a P value of 0.0001. Now, one thing that's really interesting about this study is the question of why were these individuals trying to go without eating? And so they're probing their follow-up questions. They ask these individuals why, what are their reasonings for trying to restrict their food or go without eating? And the three primary reasons that were reported were insufficiency, so food pantry insufficiency. So they were trying to stretch food to make it last longer, prioritizing other family members, so minimizing hunger for other family members, and prioritizing medical expenses. So, using their resources to purchase diapers or tampons rather than food. Now, this is a quote actually from one of my experts in my research, but I just kind of included it here. The expert said they had a patient who would say, quote, "Well, yeah, I have binge eating. I binge eat the first 2 weeks of the month because that's when we have food in the house. And then there's no food in the house the last 2 weeks of the month." So when we put these findings into context, and when Middleton and their team put these findings into context, they identify a few key points. One, food insecure adults are deliberately restricting their food for reasons other than weight and shape, right? When we go back to these three primary reasons for restricting their food, they're not talking about their body shape or their body size or anything like that. They're talking about having food insecurity, and that is why they're trying to restrict their food. So, two, existing dietary restraint measures fail to assess non-weight and shape dietary restraint. So, when we look at our current psychometric tools that we use to assess eating disorders, and particularly dietary restraint and eating disorders, they don't tend to account for food insecurity. They tend to focus mostly on weight and shape-related dietary restraint. Three, dietary restraint for other reasons is still correlated with increased eating disorder pathology. And four, clinicians should assess dietary restraint for any reasons. And again, here's just a little image of that study. And so, one of the really important things that at Nourish, we really kind of try to build on this work, and we say, well, if we know that our current treatments for binge eating disorder, which tend to focus on kind of older, more anorexocentric approaches to treating eating disorders that focus on body weight, shape, and size acceptance and satisfaction, if they only have a 30% effectiveness rate, our best treatments, that suggests that maybe there are some other psychopathologies going on besides this older kind of anorexocentric view that aren't really being addressed. And Dr. Middleton's work kind of highlights the role of food insecurity, that this might be a whole nother area that requires really different detection methods, different diagnostic methods, and different treatment approaches, right? If you try to offer someone with food insecurity a treatment that endorses body acceptance, that might not be as helpful as if you were to offer them a treatment that helps them with food planning on a budget, something like this. So that's just kind of a real life example of reporting our findings. And that is the end of module five. I now invite you to engage in the exam for this module. And then we have one more module left after this, module six, and that'll close out this course.